I'd like now to welcome Karen Coates and Jerry Redfern. They are investigative journalists. They are fellows at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism at Brandeis University, and they are co-authors of the book Eternal Harvest, The Legacy of American Bombs in Laos. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So this is a very interesting book of photographs and text by the two of you about the nation of Laos, which, as we learn in the book, is the most heavily bombed country on Earth, and a place where decades after the bombs have all fallen, people are still getting hurt, maimed, and killed by the bombs. What's going on?
Well, between 1964 and 1973, the United States military carried out the largest per capita bombing campaign in Laos. It was sort of an offshoot of the Vietnam War. And there was the equivalent of a bombing raid every 8 minutes for 9 years. 580,000 missions. Just unbelievable numbers.
Right. There are actually more than that. Those are the ones that the military still has records for. There are large ranges of dates for which the data has been lost over the years, but we know that bombing occurred. But there are minimum 580,000 documented.
And the lingering
missions.
Problem today is that up to 30%, an estimated 30% of the bombs dropped didn't detonate at the time, and so they're scattered throughout the soil today.
And one of the problems in finding them and the problems that the people who were living there have is that the records of what was dropped, when it was dropped, and how much of it was dropped don't exist.
Well, they sort of exist. The U.S. kept sort of semi-meticulous records of what was going on in terms of numbers dropped and general locations dropped. But when you're talking about a plane flying nearly at the speed of sound, dropping something, 1,000 feet off the ground, there's kind of a range of where it's actually going to fall and how it's going to scatter. Or if you're talking about dropping a couple of hundred bombs out of a B-52 from 30,000 feet, there's a huge area over which that sort of thing can actually fall. And a lot of what was dropped are what are called cluster munitions. So you'd have like a very, very large bomb casing, like you picture out of a cartoon is kind of what it looks like. But inside of that, you'd have hundreds of sub-munitions, usually about the size of your fist or a tennis ball. And these bombs would be dropped, split open in midair, and scatter those hundreds of submunitions over the space of a couple of football fields. But you have no idea exactly where they're going to land.
And one of the problems is that the unexploded pieces of these cluster bombs, some of them look like soda cans, some of them look like balls, and children are quite likely to pick them up.
Right.
Right. That's absolutely true. There are many stories of kids going out to the field just to play. They find something that looks interesting. They toss it like a ball, and it explodes. Also, they can look like rocks to farmers.
Yeah. Right. Now, why did the U.S. drop so many bombs on Laos?
That's a very good question.
there are two reasons. The first was in the north of the country was in support of the anti-communist war there. The Royal Lao government was fighting against a communist insurgency in the north of the country, so America bombed up there to support the Royal Lao government. And in much of the rest of the country, the U.S. was bombing to stop the movement of supplies down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. The North Vietnamese were running ammunition through Laos to get to South Vietnam. It's sort of a geographical reason why they did it. They ran through the jungles of Laos on the eastern part of the border there. Arms from North Vietnam through Laos and then back into South Vietnam to get across the demilitarized zone that the United States had built up in Vietnam. So the United States was bombing nearly constantly to stop all those trucks coming down the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
There were also some examples, as you write about in the book, of bombs that were dropped by people on the way to Vietnam who weren't able to drop all their bombs, so they
right.
just dumped them.
Right, because at the time, again, this was a so-called secret war. It was sort of, off the grid. And if for some reason they could not drop the bombs on Vietnam in their intended target, they would just fly back toward Thailand and drop them over Laos.
Yeah, it's kind of an irony because the bombs weren't dropped over Vietnam because we were actually at war legally with North Vietnam. So there are rules and laws that govern how you carry out a war. One of them is, if you can't, at the time at least, was if you can't see your target properly, you can't drop bombs on it. So we were not at war with Laos. We worked out an agreement with people in the government there. And since we weren't at war, we could just sort of dump them on the way back.
Which seems like a form of just insanity.
That's one way of putting it.
For sure.
So now there are bombs, there's metal, there's what people use for scrap metal all over the place. And a lot of these are in the ground. So when people start digging gardens or plowing fields, and it's very much of an agricultural nation, sometimes they find these things. How did they get into the ground?
The bombs?
Yeah.
Well, when they fell, they, you know, obviously would land on the surface and then over time would just become buried. And also, because of the climate there and the environment, during the monsoon seasons, a lot of the land just turns to muck. And so things move and shift, and these bombs will get caught up in mud flows, or they'll flow down rivers and end up, you know, embedded in banks. Or they'll, you know, if they fell in the forest areas, they would sometimes land in the treetops and then eventually fall down and become buried under leaves and sticks and things like that.
And so people are continually finding them, and over the years, tens of thousands of people have died and been injured and disfigured and disabled from these unexploded bombs that then explode and are doing so to this day.
Right. The official number is about 20,000 people since the end of war have been killed or injured in accidents involving unexploded ordnance. And that's the official number, but nobody really knows for sure because a lot of accidents simply aren't recorded.
And in fact, there was one friend of ours who reported on in the book, Jim Harris. He's in Laos now doing clearance work and is sending email dispatches. And one of his most recent email dispatches this past week was in the village where he's doing clearance work. People had started a fire because it was very cold in the evening. They started the fire on the ground, sort of like, you know, friends get together, have a bonfire outside, sit around, and the fire blew up, which is not uncommon in rural areas in Laos. And it's because the ground heated up from the fire, then also heated up an old piece of ordnance that happened to be lying on the ground there that hadn't been previously cleared, that people didn't know was there. Fire explodes. That happens. You hear stories of that all over the place in rural areas.
Now, there is, as a result of this, a kind of survival mechanism, but also kind of a culture of fear that has evolved, because you basically have to live with the fact that at any moment the ground beneath you might blow up just in the course of everyday life. What does that look like? What does that feel like in Laos?
Well, as a reporter, I've really struggled to understand what that sort of constant fear is like. And when I've asked people, and I've asked a lot of people this question, I found that different people have different coping mechanisms. And while it's true, there is this sort of background constant fear for people in rural areas that have been bombed. You know, I've heard a lot of folks say, well, At some point, you just kind of have to forget it. You can't be afraid all the time because it would consume your life. And others have stopped farming in areas where they've found too many bombs. It's altered, you know, their behavior, where they plow, where they walk, how they grow food. But everybody's a little different in how they react to this danger.
I think it's also sort of age-based, kind of thinking about it now, and that the younger the person is, the less they think and worry about it. And I think that the older that people become, the more people they see injured by bombs, perhaps people in their family have been killed by them while out farming, the more aware of it you become, the older you get. I guess the greater sense of mortality you get as you get older, as anybody gets. There, though, it also has that component, like, it's not just I'm getting old and I'm going to die eventually. I'm getting old and I've seen people around me die out of the blue, and that could happen to me or my kids or my neighbors just as well.
Yeah, another key thing that we've seen is that there are a lot of NGOs doing educational work, you know, trying to get kids to know from day one, if you see something suspicious, don't touch it, leave it alone. And we've talked to a lot of kids who understand that, but they don't really feel it until they have an accident or their friend has an accident, or, you know, they find the bomby and it blows up, and then suddenly they realize, oh, now I know what that message really means.
Yeah.
So younger people really on some level are more in danger until they until they have that extremely unfortunate experience.
Yeah, I think it's something like 40% of people who are injured now are kids. Is that right?
I think, yeah.
Something along that number. If you think about it, that's just shocking. It's just a stunning number.
Meanwhile, there is a whole business of collecting scrap metal, and so the incentive to pick up this stuff that might be dangerous is a lot higher than you might think.
Absolutely. Laos is an incredibly poor country, and in many areas where the it's a farming community, but if there's a drought or just a bad harvest or something, people have nothing else to turn to. There aren't any other jobs, but there's all this metal in the ground, and there really is a thriving scrap metal trade. And we visited some foundries outside of Vientiane, the capital, where you just watch, truckloads of metal coming in these monstrous piles. And it's not all war scrap, but a lot of it is. A lot of it is coming from what we dropped, what our government dropped years ago. And it's turned into rebar. So, the homes and buildings in Laos are actually being built on old U.S. war scrap.
And it's really scary because some of the metal that comes into these foundries is still unexploded.
Yeah. I think we went to two. We went to two different foundries. And they, of course, tell you when you walk in, oh, we don't have any bombs. Can we go look around? Oh, yeah, sure, go look around. And then there's bombs, there's pieces of bombs. There's bomb shrapnel with bits of high explosive still sticking on the inside of it. One of the foundries we went into, I walked all the way through it into the back. And literally in the back, there was a teenage boy who was there cleaning off things that were obviously explosive. They were, detonators and fuses and things like that had been taken off of bombs, and he was, scraping the explosives out of the inside of it, which is a crazy, dangerous thing to do.
Is that picture of the guy with a crowbar taking a detonator out of a bomb?
No, that was...
that scared me just to look at.
That was totally different. That was in a totally different part of the country.
Okay.
That was way down in the south of the country in a place called Adapu. And one of the most heavily bombed parts of the whole country, that's that area right there. This whole village had been relocated, I think, unwittingly on top of one of the most heavily bombed square miles in the country.
Very remote, too.
Very remote. And there was just scrap stuff everywhere. There were unexploded bombs. There was shrapnel. There were lots of unexploded bombs. But he had found this crumpled bomb casing and brought it back to the village. And I'd heard this tink, 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 tink. And I'd sort of followed the sound and came around the side of the house there, and there's this guy with a crowbar smacking at the front of a bomb, and I'm like, I took the picture, and as the shutter's clicking, I'm thinking, this is just a bad scene. I turned around and walked away.
I know, I was thinking, you could be taking that picture and then be thrown 50 feet back.
Yeah, or dead.
Yeah, or...
as could have happened to him as well, but...
Well, another thing that happened in that village, and this is common throughout the country in heavily bombed areas, villagers were telling us, it was the dry season, and right before the next planting season, farmers will burn their fields. And so they were doing that, which often causes bombs to blow up. And several villagers had to evacuate, had to, flee in the middle of the night because there was all this shrapnel just raining down on their thatch huts.
Yeah. this was like 2 days before
you
we
witnessed
got there.
This.
No, we didn't see it. We just heard it a couple of days after it happened.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, they're making all kinds of things out of bomb parts, bomb metal. They're making knives, they're making spoons, there are fences made of bomb pieces. It's just kind of surreal.
Yeah, well, it's making do with what you have.
Yeah.
I mean, so if people have lots of trees, you're going to cut down trees and make stuff out of wood. They have lots of metal lying around, so you pick up the metal and make stuff out of it.
And make planters, mm-hmm. and guys scraping his fingernails with a detonator piece or something.
Oh, yeah, that was a piece it's actually off a type of cluster munition. It's the little guidance fin that helps it, spin properly as it heads to the ground. Yeah.
We're talking about the book Eternal Harvest, The Legacy of American Bombs in Laos, with authors Karen Coates and Jerry Redfern. What was it like for you as Americans to go and talk to the various people whom you met? You met a lot of people. You were Americans. Is there anger toward Americans?
Generally, no. And another key thing is that we've found this throughout many other countries, that people are very capable of distinguishing between a government and its people. So, occasionally here and there, we'd meet some people who had hard feelings, but Overwhelmingly, no.
Yeah. It's like that. I think the other thing is, too, throughout that region, I mean, America pulled out of Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos and left three absolutely destroyed countries in its wake, but as far as they're concerned, they won. So they also have that sort of stuck in the back of their heads.
But I will say that what we did find was that people wanted their stories told. They were very for the most part, they were very happy to talk to us. And they, some of them specifically said, please tell your, you know, fellow Americans, go back home and tell our story, because they did want to be heard.
What were some of the most interesting stories that you heard? One of them that sticks in my mind is the man whose little brother disappeared during the bombings way back when.
Mm-hmm. Manipet, yeah.
Right. He was one of the most remarkable people we met in working on this story, and he worked. I'm sorry to say, he died actually just a couple weeks after we last saw him. But he worked in the north of Laos mostly to help the Hmong minority, H-M-O-N-G, Hmong minority, with schools and teaching and things like that. But he also had worked for years as a translator for various UXO groups that were doing clearance work around.
UXO meaning unexploded organisms.
Right, exactly. So the foreigners would come in to lead these groups to, you know, teach them, train them how to get rid of the bomb safely. He'd be the translator for English to, you know, Lao or Hmong or whatever it happened to be. And, he was just a remarkable person who gave an incredible amount of himself, essentially his whole life, to educating anybody who came through Ponsavan in the north of the country about the problem. It really remarkable.
And what happened with his brother was that when he was a child, their house was bombed. And so the family sort of scattered. Some people went out one way and others went the other way. And his brother was lost. His parents were split, too. He ended up living with his mother in a cave for several years. Many people during the war lived in caves for safety. And it wasn't until many years later that he was reunited with his father. But they never found his brother, who was a baby at the time. And they thought that he must have died. But it ends up that a family had found him and taken him to Thailand and managed to get him along with their family into the United States. And apparently he now lives in Minnesota somewhere.
And he came back to visit them, mm-hmm. and the brothers were actually reunited.
Right. It's just an astonishing story.
And then as we were sitting there talking to Manipet and his mother in their house, his brother happened to call on the phone from the United States.
From the United States, where he's living and working as a doctor. Amazing stories. Now, talk about this time where people were living and surviving and sometimes not surviving in these caves.
The main thing to know about Laos is it's actually an extremely mountainous country, which has been part of the reason why it's been able to stay as its own country for all these years. It's like a rumpled bedsheet. There's almost no flat land in most of the country. But it's all limestone mountains, so the mountains in most places are riddled with caves. There's caves all over the place. When the bombing began, and actually not just when it began, as it continued, a lot of it seems to be pretty indiscriminate, and when it wasn't indiscriminate, it was essentially shoot and bomb anything that moved. And people got used to hearing the planes coming, you'd hide wherever you could, get out of the way, because there was a likelihood you'd be shot, bombed, killed. And houses were destroyed, whole, you know, tiny little villages were burned to the ground. And after a while, the only safe places left were caves, and there were caves everywhere, so people would go there and build whole villages and towns inside of cave complexes. It's really quite remarkable.
And there are still people who have, is it grave markers inside the caves? Or?
Well, there is one very large cave that was hit with an airplane, and a few hundred people were living inside at the time, and they all died.
Yeah, it was essentially a whole large village that was living inside there. There was a medical facility. They taught kids there. People would come out during the day and do some farming if they could and then go back into the cave at night. But it took a direct hit, and literally the ceiling of the cave collapsed on everybody that was inside of it. And
so now there's sort of a memorial site there. I think there are maybe only one or two survivors, but everybody else was killed.
People were dying not only from bombings, but from chemical poisoning at the time. So they would go out and hunt for food, and it would be poisoned.
You know, there's not a lot of hard information on the chemicals used in Laos. There's more information on Vietnam, but in Laos it's really hard to determine exactly what was dropped where. But what we've heard are these stories of people living in the caves, going out foraging for food, coming back with poisoning. We did visit one family in the south of the country where the woman was digging and she hit a bomb and it started smoking. And so she ran to the river to try to wash it off, but it just made it worse. So, and there are other reports like that, people talking about these chemical bombs, which they don't exactly know what they are, but they've found them still today.
Mm-hmm. Now, was there white phosphorus used?
Oh, there's a lot of white phosphorus used all over the place, yeah.
And is that still, are there still some unexploded white phosphorus bombs basically lying in wait?
Oh, yeah. It's one of the most, we've seen a number of detonations for clearance groups. They go out and to get rid of the explosive. It's not like you take it home and take it apart or anything like that. You tend to blow it up in situ. And one of the most amazing detonations we've ever seen was a white phosphorus detonation. And these were actually, you'd think, oh, white phosphorus bomb, it's got to be a big thing. And some of them were, but some of them were actually really tiny. And what we saw were essentially, they looked like two rusty soda cans that a couple of kids found while tending cattle. So think about that. And white phosphorus ignites when it comes in contact with air. So it's not like you have to, you know, explode it to get it to ignite, right? You just have to open up the can and the thing will blow up on its own. So what you do to detonate this thing, we found out, is you carefully put it in a pit with some explosive underneath it, and all you're really trying to do is toss the cans up into the air and rupture the cans, and they'll burn themselves up. So these two little soda cans, when they detonated them, it was mind-blowing.
An amazing
unbelievably
explosion.
Huge explosion, and, you know, 1,000-foot-tall column of flame and smoke that came out of it. It was unbelievable. So yes, these things are still out there. Unfortunately, and still dangerous today, yeah.
There is an entire profession of bomb clearing that people do, and there's a very nice chapter about this fellow you mentioned named Jim Harris, who is really a living and very interesting and I think important example of when you go try to do aid in a foreign country, it works a whole lot better to be committed, form relationships, have people know that you're there in the for the long term, mm-hmm. rather than just sort of go in and do your job.
Absolutely. He talks about that a lot, where the first thing he does is to go out through the village with his team and talk to people. Just talk to them on a human level. And he does a lot of other work, too, by taking kids to the doctor when they need, you know, medical care. He brings books to villages. And he's more than just, as he puts it, the guy in the suit who shows up. He's, you know, somebody that people can trust.
And he tends to go back time and again. That's another thing that happens with a lot of, not just clearance groups, but any sort of aid agency working in the developing world that we've seen throughout Southeast Asia. Is a group will have a project, they'll do it for a year, and then they leave. And the people in areas get used to, oh, well, yeah, the aid group showed up 10 years ago and, you know, everybody got their shots, but we haven't seen a doctor since then, for example.
Right.
Something like that. But he makes a point of going back to villages or districts, you know, year after year, building up relationships, finding out deeper problems, helping with things like that.
And then when that kind of trust is established, you can do bomb clearance in a more effective way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. People constantly, when with the couple of times that we've seen him in the field has usually been on like his second or third year in a particular place, and people literally come out of the woods, the woodwork, saying, oh, I got a bomb here, I got a bomb there, whereas, you know, in the first year people knew about this stuff, but yeah, it's the foreigner, I guess I should probably tell him about something, you don't remember it, but by the second, third follow-on years that he's there, people are showing up all the time and telling him about stuff.
Sometimes they're showing up with the bombs in their hands, which is a bit of a problem.
Yeah.
And as you write, clearance people just hate it when people bring them bombs.
Yes.
But
that's a really bad day.
So what is the work of clearance like? How do they find the bombs? I mean, sometimes you read about bomb-sniffing dogs and things like that, but what's actually happening in Laos?
Honestly, a lot of the time it's really boring because it is such a painstaking process where every inch of land has to be checked with a metal detector. And so they set up stakes in rows, and they go back and forth and back and forth with these detectors. And if the signal goes off, they mark the spot, and then eventually, you know, someone will come back and check all the marked spots, digging very carefully around.
Like with a garden spade, essentially. Yeah. You're like going in with your fingers carefully, digging down in case, you know, you don't know what you're going to find under the ground.
It could be a rusty nail or it could be a bomb. And you never know until you actually find it.
So it's just a really, really long, painstaking process. And the thing is that it kind of has to be. It's like there's a bureaucracy. You set up a camp with these guys, it's sometimes women, to do this sort of clearance work, and there's this whole series of procedures that everybody has to follow. And the medic sits over here, and the team leader stands over there, and you stake everything out very carefully, and then you go over everything one way, and then you pick at random a 10% and go back and make sure you didn't miss anything. And it's very slow and bureaucratic, but has to be, because it's life and death sort of stuff.
And then if you do that year after year, first of all, it has to be funded, which is not to be taken for granted, because the U.S. hasn't really taken responsibility for this, have they, the U.S. government?
The U.S. government has given toward clearance. This year, just in January, in the latest budget, $12 million was set aside for clearance and aid work, educational work in Laos. That's the most ever. So the United States is giving toward it, but it is not nearly enough to finish the job by any stretch.
To sort of put it in perspective, on average, the United States was spending $17 million a day to drop bombs on Laos. Excuse me. And this year, it's going to be $12 million for the year to do clearance work and education and helping victims of UXO accidents. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think the number that you have in your book is we spent in today's dollars a total of $56 billion bombing just Laos.
Right.
Not even Vietnam.
No.
And so the clearing of these bombs, I mean, has there been a calculation of what it would take to totally de-bombify whatever the country?
There is one estimate of $16 billion. And it's a very rough, you know, guesstimate, really, based on what is thought to remain in the ground versus how much it costs to clear an area. But that's the closest estimate, $16 billion.
Who are the people doing clearance? Are they all foreigners? Are there people from Laos themselves learning this?
There are a wide range of groups. There's a national group that does clearance, and then many international NGOs. And companies.
Yeah, now, the last couple of years, many private companies doing it. But the people actually getting their hands dirty doing the work are, I think, almost all Lao. Some of the team leaders come from places like Cambodia next door, where they've had training and doing other sort of clearance work. And many of the people who run sort of teams out in the field, the sort of field operators, I'm not sure how else you'd put it, tend to be Western foreigners or Japanese. But there are some Lao folks, I think, out there now doing that, like through UXO Lao.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I keep thinking about, because on this program we've talked a number of times about this mammal called the sao lao, which is a very critically endangered mammal, only recently discovered by science, who lives on the border of Laos and Vietnam, and they weren't even sure if it was extinct, and then recently they had a camera trap picture of one, and that was very exciting. But the amount of wildlife that was killed during the bombings was just unfathomable. And now when you detonate these bombs in order to get rid of their threat, you're still doing it in jungles, and there's still some effect on wildlife. Do people talk about that at all, or is it really not considered an issue?
Wow, I hadn't really thought about it that way. No, that's not, as far as I know, considered an issue at all. A bigger issue, honestly, in Laos is Lao people going out, and they really like bushmeat, essentially. They really like eating birds. And just general Lao hunters have been, I think, a bigger threat to wildlife there than bombs at this point.
We're talking about the book Eternal Harvest, The Legacy of American Bombs in Laos, with authors Karen Coates and Jerry Redfern. Now, how did you get involved in this whole project, both of you?
Well, we'd been living and working in Southeast Asia for quite a while, and we were assigned by Archaeology Magazine in 2005 to go to an area called the Plain of Jars, which is this massive area of archaeological sites, these huge stone jars, to do a story on that. And we found that the archaeologist working there was working in conjunction with a bomb clearance team to clear the main tourist sites of the jars. And we knew about this history, and we knew of the bombings. We'd been there before, but we didn't understand the full scope of it until we started working on that story and kept hearing about more accidents. And we met a kid in the hospital who had an accident in his farm field. And we just sort of looked at each other and said, this is a much bigger story that we need to cover.
Can you tell us a little bit about this Plain of Jars and what these jars are? They're quite dramatic.
Wow, yeah. It's only until the last couple of years they're fairly sure that they were burial urns. And it was they don't know exactly who made them or exactly for what purpose. They only recently figured out where they came from because the stone that they're made of in most places isn't necessarily the stone where they're sitting, so they would have been dragged. These things weigh tons. These things would have been dragged miles and miles and miles, they found. But yeah, they're
as big as a person, some of them.
Yeah.
And the sites are scattered all over the place. Some of them are on these open plains, but others are on mountaintops in the middle of the forest. I mean, they're just...
And you
it's
wonder
incredible.
How they got them up there.
Yeah.
These were made thousands of years ago at this point, so... Yeah, it's not like they, you know, hired a helicopter to fly them up on top of a mountaintop. Somebody, you know, dragged it up there with some oxen or something. They really don't know. It's just spectacular.
The Lao story is that they were used for Lao Lao, which is the local alcohol of choice.
Yeah, they were saying these were big Lao Lao tumblers, and you drink your rice wine out of it. that would be unlikely, but it was one theory.
Are there any similar jars like that they use today for Lao Lao?
Not for Lao Lao, no.
No.
Not quite like that.
So these jars were also heavily bombed, which is why, first of all, there's a lot of them have been damaged, but also it's an archaeological site that in theory could attract tourists, but there's bombs everywhere.
The three main sites actually near Ponsavan have been cleared, and a couple of the other lesser sites at this point as well. So if anybody's thinking of going to look at them, you should go. It's not a danger at this point. But it is true that particularly the sites 1, 2, and 3 near Ponsavan were heavily bombed, and areas around there were heavily bombed.
And those were cleared. Was that place given priority because it was an archaeological site, a clearance priority?
Right, that was part of that project, to clear that area for tourists. But, you know, that brings up something else we should note, that for the most part, it's safe to walk on top of bombs when they're embedded in the soil and you can't see them. It's not like landmines. But if they're on the surface, if they're moving, you know, that's where the danger is. You don't want to pick one up and move it.
Or kick it, or turn it over to see it a little more closely.
Right.
If you can see it, that's a problem. If it's buried under the ground,
generally speaking,
you can walk around and not have a problem. So,
did you come across any bombs yourselves?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So you're walking along and you see one?
Yeah.
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 I mean, part of that's because we were with clearance teams that were looking for it. Right. They would find them. But there was also a time we were out with that archaeologist we were talking about on a second trip, looking for the places where they found a quarry site while we were there. And when we were looking around this quarry site, well, there was a 30-year-old cluster bomb literally just lying on top of the jungle leaves and stuff, sitting there, you know, yellow and silver, and it was like somebody had dropped it there while walking along.
Yeah, that was kind of bizarre because it almost looked like new.
Yeah. It's also kind of scary because these cluster bombs, like we were saying, you don't drop a cluster munition. You drop hundreds of them at once. So if you see one and you realize they probably had a high failure rate, if there's one, there's the grand likelihood there are others that you don't see around you. So
were they designed to have a high failure rate and explode later? No, it was just
no.
Bad technology.
Perhaps bad usage. We went to another site where there were thousands that were in an area actually probably the size of this restaurant. I mean, if you think about that, just buried in layers in the ground, where the bombs have probably been dropped too low. that the technology that went into most of these cluster munitions, where you have this little tennis ball, and inside, at the middle of the tennis ball, it was like one of those wind-up watch mechanisms where you shake your wrist to wind your watch. And either it had to spin a certain number of times after it was ejected from the plane, or it had to spin at a certain speed. But it was a tiny little mechanism like that. You have hundreds and hundreds of these mechanisms inside of one of these bombs, one for each of these cluster munitions, and they just didn't work real well. So.
And actually now, by law, in the future, after 2018, any cluster munitions that the United States uses will have to have a failure rate not exceeding 1%. So there's an effort now to design sort of a more efficient bomb, you'd say.
But they're still horrifying weapons because they're just designed to shred life. I mean, to shred flesh.
Well, the military will tell you that they have, we have different cluster munitions for different purposes, you know. But generally, yeah, they are designed to shred flesh. But there are others that are designed to pierce armor.
Yeah.
Or, you know, wait for a vehicle to drop by and blow up and things like that. That's the other thing, too, that makes some of this clearance work so difficult. So what I was talking about, that little watch mechanism, that's just one type of what they used. There were hundreds of different types of bombs and cluster munitions that were dropped. There are ones that were magnetically triggered. There are others that would have like little shake sensors in it, essentially would hit the ground and wait for something to rumble by and then blow up. There were, if you can think of it, somebody figured out a way to stick it in a bomb and then it was dropped on Laos. So there's just an unbelievable number of different styles.
So you were there, you met all kinds of people, and as you say, they had really different ways of dealing with the fear that permeates their daily life, because these things are still pretty much all over the country. Is that right? Yeah.
There are certain provinces that aren't so heavily bombed and it's not so much of a threat, but still there is unexploded ordnance all over the country.
Yeah, the only place that they know that they don't have records for any bombs being dropped is in the capital, Vientiane. But every other province and most other districts have at least one, you know, mission targeted there.
So you also witnessed how people have dealt with and continue to deal with trauma. Can you talk about that a bit? Because one of the things that I think is so interesting is how different cultures deal with trauma, with forgiveness or not forgiveness, letting go or not letting go.
It's in many ways very difficult in Laos for people who have had accidents because there are so few services. I mean, if you go through a trauma, it's not like you have a clinic to go to seek help. On the other hand, one inspiring thing we've found throughout the country is a very strong community. I mean, villages will come together to help people, which is something that we don't always see in all the places where we report. So, you know, families help each other, but still it's, especially for people who have become blind or lost a limb in an accident, if they can't work anymore, there's a huge psychological toll because they can no longer provide for their family. And there's a really big cycle of depression, and there's not much, you know, in the way of help for that.
There's a story you tell of a man who was doing very well with his family, and then he lost his arms, and the burden of the family was then put on his wife, who had to do basically catering for people's weddings and things like that, and the family just had a really hard time, both financially and emotionally.
Yeah, yeah, it's a common story.
And he's actually almost one of the lucky ones, because he lived in a larger town in Ponsavan in the north, and he was able to get some aid from a foreign aid group that gave him some money and I think some cattle to be able to raise to try to help the family along. If you live in a truly rural village in Laos and something like that happens to you, I mean, the village, they won't turn you out into a forest, but there's only so much a thatch hut village is going to be able to do for somebody with no arms or no feet or blind or things like that.
There's also a set of spiritual traditions, and one of the things I thought was interesting was there's this idea that if somebody dies from an accident, their spirit doesn't realize that it's died and kind of stays around and haunts the place.
It's almost as though the spirit has not been put to rest, and in many places there are separate graveyards for people who died in accidents. And there was one village where scrap collecting is very common there. It's another remote village, very poor, where we visited this graveyard in this bamboo forest, and almost everybody in it had died in a recent UXO accident.
Yeah.
So it just goes on and on. Do you find that people have, by and large, forgiven the United States, or do they still hold some anger?
I think for a lot of people, I would say forgiveness, but also they've forgotten. I mean, not in the sense that it didn't happen or that they don't remember it, but what we hear a lot is that was in the past. That was a different time. That was war. It's not war anymore. And,
There's also that idea that Karen brought up earlier, that the people do a very good job of distinguishing between a government and the government doing something and the people doing something. I mean, I think we've seen that actually all over throughout Asia, in places where people live in countries with really bad governments. And you realize very quickly that the bad government is not the fault of the people who live in the country. And I think they extend that toward us as well, which has always been very gracious, at the very least.
But what a lot of people also have said is that they would like the United States government to do more to help clean up the mess.
No
Even
question.
Though that was then, things are different now. They would like the government to do something else.
It is interesting that Americans seem to be singularly bad at distinguishing between people and their governments.
It does seem
yeah.
that way, doesn't it? Yeah. I'm guessing that most people in Iran are not the Iranian government, for
yeah,
example.
Exactly.
So.
For example. We're talking about the book Eternal Harvest, The Legacy of American Bombs in Laos, with journalists Karen Coates and Jerry Redfern. It sounds like you guys, or it feels from the book, like you guys kind of fell in love with the country.
We did before we started this book.
Yeah, not kind of, 100%. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
What do you mean before you started? Because you were
traveled
living
there before, and yes, absolutely fell in love with the country, the people. The people tend to be so laid back, so generous. It's a beautiful country, incredible food, just lovely.
What do they eat?
The best food on earth.
It tends to be very spicy, traditionally. A lot of it is obviously homegrown rice-based, sticky rice, where you have a big basket of sticky rice and you take a bit and you roll it into a ball and then you dip it into various curries or soups or a lot of it is hunted meat, foraged foods, lots and lots of vegetables and herbs.
Yeah. In a way, certain aspects of it almost seem like New Mexican food. If you substitute rice for corn, but then you have lots of garlic, lots and lots of chilies, and roasted meats and barbecue type things. You could almost, if you squint, say to yourself, "This kind of looks like a New Mexican barbecue." I could see that.
Yeah,
and it is a very rural country, and mm-hmm. a lot of the people make their living from basically farming agriculture.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm not even sure that they know exactly how many Lao people are in Laos now. They think now it might be somewhere close to 10 million people. I mean, it's a fairly large country, roughly the size, I think, of California-ish, but
still very sparsely populated.
Sparsely populated.
Was there a large migration out of Laos?
During the war?
Yeah.
Yeah,
yes.
There was huge numbers of people crossed the Mekong River into Thailand in particular, much of that to escape the bombing, but then also to escape other fighting and things like that.
So what is current international policy on cluster bombs at this point in history, and what is the U.S. participation in those politics?
There is an international ban on cluster munitions, but the United States has not signed it. And that's really the bottom line.
Well, a treaty
right.
to ban
right.
cluster munitions. The United States hasn't signed it and has in certain ways worked to keep other countries from signing it.
And so over 100 countries have signed it, but the big ones haven't.
Yeah, the right. main munitions manufacturing countries haven't. So U.S., Russia, China, I think Brazil hasn't, South Africa, places that make cluster munitions and sell them to other countries.
And so what can U.S. citizens do, if anything, to, first of all, participate in clearing Laos of bombs and in preventing future cluster bomb catastrophes?
Well, we've been talking a lot about that because we get this question a lot. And I think for a lot of Americans, the most basic thing they can do is donate to a group that's doing work on the ground there. But if they want to be politically active first off, hold the government accountable and make sure that a secret war like this never happens again. But then also to campaign for lobby for more money toward clearance and for the United States to sign the ban on cluster munitions.
Yeah, I would agree with that pretty much completely. And just to point out, too, I think a lot of people would say, well, that just couldn't happen again. You couldn't have such a massive bombing campaign be in secret as it was for nearly 6-7 years, kept from the American public for that long. Well, that just couldn't happen again. But actually it has, not at the same level, but the targeted killings, the drone strikes in Pakistan and Afghanistan and other countries in Yemen and other places around the world, those were all conducted essentially in secret for years before reporters figured it out and started reporting on it. So it's not at all inconceivable.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's this idea that everybody in the world has smartphones and is uploading pictures of everything they see all over the world, but that's not necessarily the case.
Or even if they are, it takes a while for that to filter through back to another country to say, this is, you did this. This is not just Pakistani homes blowing up apropos of nothing.
So you have published this book, Eternal Harvest. It's published by Things Asian Press. So what are you doing? Are you doing a book tour to let people know about Laos and the unexploded bombs and so on?
We'll be doing a series of talks. We have given several talks already. Our presentation usually involves a slideshow, a video, and then a question and answer period. We'll be doing this for quite some time.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Are you planning on going back to Laos?
Yes.
As a matter of fact, we might be there, I guess, in April is what it's looking like at this point.
Hopefully.
We hope to, yeah.
Have the people who are in this book seen it yet?
Some of them have.
Yeah. Some of them live very, very far off the beaten track, so it's kind of difficult to get books out to them. But, a lot of people have seen it.
How have the people in Laos responded so far?
So far, we've had amazing response and requests to come and talk in Laos.
For a lot of this, they're just so happy to have somebody get books out, get the word out, be talking about this back in the United States, telling about these problems from Laos here, because that just hasn't been happening to this point.
Karen Coates and Jerry Redfern are co-authors of the book Eternal Harvest, The Legacy of American Bombs in Laos. They are fellows with the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism at Brandeis University. And you are a photographer, Jerry. You are the you wrote the text, Karen, and it's just a wonderful book and highly recommended for all Americans to read. The front cover has pictures of a landscape that is full of bomb craters. Are those bomb craters starting to heal?
Those bomb craters that you see on the cover there are 30, 35 years old at this point. So not exactly. And in fact, in a lot of places, the people don't necessarily... It's like with the scrap collecting. They don't necessarily want it to heal because they make great water buffalo ponds and fish ponds and things like that after the fact. So they're actually some of them used.
Very interesting. Well, it's a fantastic book, and I want to thank you both very much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.